From the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, this is 30 Laps of Dick. I'm Richard Lyon. Welcome. Hey, it's 100 episodes. Where has all that time gone? 30 Laps of Dick, 100 episodes. But hey, let's look forward. Let's not look back. This week, an old favourite, Granville. How do you spell pepper? Is it 6 p's or 7? I can see the side of the lorry now. Right, famous treacle to toffee. And Granville says, you're going to need to get a bigger lorry if you want that on the side of it. Let's go to Yorkshire in this 100th episode in 30 laps. Yeah, and let's go for a drive in Gladys Emanuel's Morris Minor. And we learn a little bit more about the Morris Minor. And we might even have time for a couple more of those famous chase cars from last week. We've got it all sewn up this week in 30 laps. So, where do we start? Well, let's start with the emblem, shall we? The emblem of the Morris Minor, the ox fording the River Isis, is the traditional emblem of William Morris's hometown of Oxford and used in the Oxford coat of arms. And while we're on the subject of background, Arkwright's grocery shop is in Bally, a small suburb of Doncaster in South Yorkshire. 15A Lister Avenue, Doncaster, to be precise. For the history of the Morris Minor, we turn to Morris Minor 1000, History of Our Classic Car, and it's from Our Classic Car website. So it's ourclassiccar.com.au. It appears to be an editorial, and therefore we do not have the person, or we do not know the person who wrote it. But that's never stopped us before, hey? The Morris Minor was designed by Alec Issigonis and was introduced at the Earl's Court Motor Show in September 1948. More than 1.3 million Morris Minors were produced between 1948 and 1972. Initially, only two models were available, a two-door saloon and a convertible known as a tourer. The Minor was a relatively roomy car with excellent handling, cornering, and within the means of the working man. This iconic British car was manufactured in three series. The original car, the MM, was produced from 48 to 1953 as a two-door saloon and a two-door convertible from 1950 as a four-door saloon. At some point close to the model's launch, Issigonis decided that the car looked too narrow and had a pre-production model cut in half from front to back and moved apart the shape until aesthetically pleasing. This meant the car needed to be 4 inches wider, and so a fillet strip was added to the centre, which remained visible on the bonnet right until production ended. Early cars had headlights set in the grille, which didn't meet safety requirements for export to the United States. And so when exports began in 1949, the headlamps were mounted higher on the wings. This became the standard position for all miners in 1951. The car was powered by a mighty 918cc Morris side valve engine. In 1952, the Series 2 was introduced with updates of a 103cc Austin-designed A-Series engine, and a state version, the Traveller, was introduced along with the van and pickup models. The Traveller features an external varnished wood frame, which was structural, giving the car its iconic appearance. and 1954, the grille and dashboard were redesigned. The Morris 1000 was a 1956 upgrade with an engine capacity to 948 cc's. The two-piece split windscreen was replaced by a modern curved one-piece until one-piece unit, and the rear window was enlarged to increase visibility. In 1961, the semaphore-style traffic indicators were replaced by flashing directional indicators. In 1961, the Morris Minor became the first British car to sell more than 1 million and was celebrated with a limited run of 350 two-door saloons in a distinctive lilac paintwork and a white interior. The badge was modified to read Minor 1 million instead of Minor 1000. But let's go back into the depth of it all, shall we? The Morris Minor we all know and love was not the first car to bear the name. The first Morris Minor was launched on the 1st of September 1928. It was designed to compete directly with Austin 7. The little fabric-bodied car was innovative in the fact that it had an 847cc overhead camshaft engine. This sporty little engine eventually gave rise to the first MG Midget. By 1931, a new Minor was in production which featured a side valve engine instead of the overhead cam version and a new lower price tag of £100. Sadly, this Minor was only in production until 1934, at which time the Depression hit and Morris saw its market share fall from 51% down to just 27%. The Minor was replaced by successive versions of the Morris 8. The Minor name lay dormant until after the Second World War. Alec Issigonis will be remembered as one of the most innovative car designers of all time. He was born in 1906 in Smyrna, Turkey. His father, a naturalised British subject of Greek descent, ran a marine engineering business, and his mother was the daughter of a wealthy Bavarian brewer. The Issigonis family fled to England in 1922 to escape the Turkish invasion of Smyrna. Sadly, Alec's father died en route in Malta. It was Alec's mother's intention for him to go to art school, but he decided to take a three-year engineering course at Battersea Polytechnic. He was offered a job with the Roots Group at the Humber Drawing Office in Coventry. Here he worked on the even keel independent suspension design. After 2 years, he met Robert Boyle, chief engineer at Morris, who offered him a job at Cowley, where he developed an independent suspension system for the M10, which, incidentally, was to be Morris's first monocoque constructed car. The M10 saw production in 1938, but without Issigonis. The new suspension or the rack and pinion steering system he had also designed. These concepts were also due to be used in a new small MG saloon, which was to enter production in 1940. But the outbreak of war in September 1939 meant that the car was not produced until 1947. With the outbreak of World War II, Issigonis was set to work designing a variety of military vehicles, including an amphibious tank. In the early 1940s, Miles Thomas, the vice chairman, managing director of the Nuffield organisation, expressed an interest in developing a new small car to go into production after the war. That task was given to Issigonis. It is well known that Issigonis had a strong belief that a car should be and offer as much payload as possible in the minimum space, a concept he successfully took to the extreme with a 1959 Mini. Alec Issigonis was taken out of the drawing office at Cowley Works and given his own development shop. He was allocated two draftsmen to turn his ideas into drawings. Reg Job drew up the body engines and Jack Daniels the running gear. Issigonis was famed for producing quick sketches of his designs on anything that came to hand. It was left to Job and Daniels to translate these ideas into workable drawings. by 1942, Zagonis had produced a scale model of the new car from these rough drawings that had been cleaned up by his two draftsmen. A handmade prototype was created. By December of 1943, the completed prototype, known as the Mosquito, was ready for the road. The Mosquito had a distinct American styling, looking very much like a scaled-down version of a 1941 Packard Clipper. When Lord Nuffield saw the Mosquito prototype, he was said to be furious, likening it to a poached egg. Lord Nuffield was a traditionalist and expected all Morris cars to have an upright grille and separate running boards. He had quite a dislike for Zagonis, refusing to call him by his name and only referring to him as that foreign chap. However, the Mosquito was ready for the road, but due to the ongoing war, there was no domestic car production. Zagonis spent the intervening years refining and perfecting the prototype. In 1946, with the war ended, Morris's main priority was getting back into production by revving up the pre-war Series E 8 horsepower and the two other stablemates, the 1.5-litre Morris Oxford Series MO and the 2.2-litre Morris 6, as well as the upmarket Wolseley version of these vehicles. There was, however, no Wolseley version of the Minor, although evidence exists that there was a prototype, the Wolseley Minor, and a prototype MG variants. But of course the car did go into production, but not without a few changes, one being the engine. Several factors led to the flat 4 being dropped, problems with vibration, and a new unit still hadn't been solved, and the British system of taxation meant it was more cost-effective to use the 918cc traditional four-cylinder side valve engine from the Morris E8. This was successfully fitted into a prototype with a little modification to the steering. Lord Nuffield also objected to the name Mosquito, and that was dropped in favour of resurrecting the Minor name. Must have been quite a bloke, this Lord Nuffield. Zagonis wasn't entirely happy with the Minor's appearance. It was only 57 inches wide, and he thought it looked too tall and too narrow. He therefore had one of the prototypes cut down the middle, as we have mentioned previously, and moved the two halves apart. It was left to Reg's job once again to redraw the body to incorporate the extra 4 inches in width. Production body shells started at Nuffield Metal Products in Birmingham, in July of 1948, and the first car rolled off the production line September 20, 1948. The two body styles were produced, a two-door saloon and a tourer. An example of each was prepared for the forthcoming British Motor Show at Earl's Court. Due to the war, it was to be the first motor show to be held for 10 years, and the Minor was launched.
Well, you get up that morning, you get on the bus, you don't think about nothing. Don't want to raise no fuss. You come home in the evening, turn the TV on. You ain't going nowhere. You just ride along, ride along, ride along.
And we're riding along this afternoon, or today, with Morris Minor. It was expected the Minor would take back seat to the other two launches, the MO and the MS, but instead it was an instant success with the public and the press. Motor magazine dubbed it a show sensation. Morris had underestimated the demand of the new model and had passed production figures of those for the Morris 8, the car it had replaced. These figures allowed for 400 cars to be built per week. Additional lines were built to allow production to 1,000 cars a week. At its peak in later years, it rose to 3,000 cars a week. That was quite something in 1948. 1956 brought one of the most radical transformations to the Morris Minor. The Minor emerged with a single, new, large, one-piece windscreen, which was larger than the split screen, but curiously retained the split screen's wiper mechanism. The rear window was also enlarged, giving the Miner excellent all-round visibility. The rear wings had a smaller wheel cut out, which made the car look somewhat more solid. A new version of the A-Series engine was fitted along with a new gearbox. 948cc gave an output of 37 brake horsepower and a top speed of 74 miles an hour. Morris Minor badges were replaced with Morris 1000 on the boot, lid and sides of the bonnet. Inside the glove boxes gained lids, although this was practically useless on the driver's side. The wire steering wheel was discarded and a small black dished wheel took its place. A smaller gear stick was positioned further back and a new handbrake lever was fitted. Turn indicators were operated from a stalk on the steering wheel column as opposed to under the dash switch of previous cars. December 22, 1960, saw a milestone in the history of the Morris Minor. The millionth car rolled off the production line at Cowley. To celebrate this, Morris created 350 Minor Millions, painted in a strange choice of lilac with off-white upholstery. All millions were carried special Morris 1 million badges in place of the usual Morris 1000. No real changes came about till late 1961. At long last, trafficators gave way to flashing indicators, although these were incorporated in an existing tail lamp and side light units. Leather upholstery on the deluxe Miners gave way to two-tone vinyl trim. The standard models got the same style of upholstery, but in a single colour. For some reason, the glove box lost their lids again. In 1962, production started on the Austin and Morris 1100, and this time BNC decided to rationalise the range of engines used in their cars to just three different sizes. New Miners were fitted with a traditional inline version of the transverse engine used in the new 1100. The new engine had a 30% increase of power over the old one. A bigger clutch was mated to an improved gearbox to handle the extra power. To aid stopping, which is always handy, Miner was fitted with 8-inch front brake drum brakes. Final drive gearing was raised from 4.55 to 4.22. 63 saw an improved windscreen washer system and finally wipers that worked in the same direction. There was also a key operated lock in both doors. New larger light clusters, front and rear, were also introduced, the front ones having separate sections for the side lights and indicators. Seat belts were also fitted in Britain in anticipation of the 1964 legislation. Talking about 1964, new interior trim was introduced. The stitching in the upholstery had gone in favour of cheaper bonded vinyl. The speedometer was given a black face and was set in an anodised aluminium plate. A new two-spoke steering wheel was fitted to match those fitted to the Mini and the 1100. The passenger glove box got its lid back. 65 saw a few safety features fitted to the Miner. The rear view mirror was given a plastic edging and foam padding was fitted to the parcel shelf. The old push-button starter had finally given way to a combination ignition and starter switch, and the boot lid gained a telescopic stay. In 1968, BMC became part of British Leyland, which seemed to signal the beginning of the end for the Miner. In June 1969, the last convertible came off the production line. Traveller Assembly was moved to Adderley Park in Birmingham in July of that year. Strangely, in 1970, optional reclining front seats were introduced. One wonders why they bothered, considering the fact that the convertible already ceased production and that the saloon was about to offer the same fate. Some cars were fitted with alternators rather than dynamos, and on the 12th of November 1970, the last saloon was built. In 1971, some travellers were fitted with steering locks. It's assumed that these were fitted to some export models and that excess stock was being used up. Production of the Traveller continued, but only until April 1971. The final miner to be produced was a GPO van, government post office, of course, van which rolled off the assembly line in December of that year, 1971. In just over 22 years of production, some 1.6 million miners were made. And there you have it, folks, a brief history of the Morris Minor 1000 and the wonderful car that Gladys Emanuel used to drive around to keep away from Mr. Arkwright. Next time you see Gladys driving that in one of the numerous repeats of that program on television, you will be able to see whether she had an early version or a later version. It's a bit of homework for you. And that comes from the website ourclassiccars.co.uk/Morris Minor 1000 history.
Get burned. We don't have to feel like dirt anymore. Though love's not earned, baby, it's our turn. We were always looking for true love with our heads in the clouds, just a little off course.
And that song was, we haven't got to the chorus yet, but that song is called Drive South. And that's what we were doing in the Morris Minor with Gladys Emanuel. And no doubt Arkwright in the rearview mirror. Talking about pursuits, and we're not talking about Gladys Emanuel being pursued by a little small grey-haired grocer. Let's go back to Autocar from last week and some of the best movie car chases, some of the best cars in those movies. And this was written by Al Sutty. I think we're up to that wonderful movie Duel from 1971. Also another movie. Car movie that came out in 1971 was Vanishing Point. That featured a Dodge 1970 Dodge Charger, Dodge Challenger RT. It ended up the star of the film for no other reason than the director wanted to thank Chrysler for providing the filmmaker 20th Century Fox with rental cars for $1 a day. So, the Challenger got the lead role, and various other Chrysler brands were used throughout the film for police cars. Five Challengers were supplied for the film, all in Alpine White. Most of them were 7.2 litre V8s, but also a 6.3 V8 was used as well. All were returned at the end of filming, although two needed considerable rebuilding after being used for jumps. They were all standard, other than stronger rear shock absorbers, and the only reported problems came from the desert dust getting into every cranny that needed constant cleaning to keep the cars running smoothly. The Challenger was produced between 69 and 1983 over two generations, and then the nameplate was revived in 2008, and it is produced to this day, with US sales of 60,997 in 2019 alone. But of course, let's go back to James Bond and the Man with the Golden Gun in 1974. Rarely has a duller car enjoyed a more starring role than an AMC Hornet that was used in the James Bond film The Man with the Golden Gun. Roger Moore plays Bond and is busy chasing villain Scaramanga, played, of course, by Christopher Lee, when he ends up on the wrong side of a river. Cue a corkscrew bridge jump that has imprinted the Hornet on the moviegoers' minds forever. For the stunt, the car had the steering wheel moved to the centre of the cabin, had larger wheels fitted and lowered suspension. There were some precedents for this jump, as Hornets had been used in Jay Milligan's Astro Spiral Javril stunt show. In the film, the jump was completed in one attempt, and it was the first time this type of stunt had ever been used in a film. The Hornet was built over a single model generation between 69 and 1977. Engines range from a 3.3-litre to a straight-up 5.9-litre V8. The right to use the Hornet name was an inheritance from Hudson, a predecessor company of AMC, which is American Motor Corporation. Small by US standards, sales held up better than those of larger models during the sharp fuel price rises of the 1970s. We finish today with the Ford Granada that was used in the Sweeney in 1977 to great effect. Regan, Carter and a European Ford Granada flying through the streets of London had become a British cult small screen staple by the time of this feature film. By this time, the Granada had taken over from the console model used in the early television series, but they were all 3-litre S models or 3-litre V6, powered with 150 horses. Again, as with the television series, the film sourced its cars directly from Ford, which was only too happy with the exposure on the big screen. The Granada would be facelifted in 1977 and then run on until 1985. Of course, don't forget the Mark 10 Jags that were in that show that, according to Dennis Waterman, who played Sergeant Carter, were virtually indestructible. They said they tried real hard on several occasions to knock a few of them over, but they just kept running. And then we'll leave chase cars for another week. We might pick that up in another episode. And that's where we might leave it today, I think. We've done a couple more famous cars from the best movie car chases, and that was, of course, compiled for Auto Car Magazine by Al Sutty. And I hope you enjoyed our little trip down memory lane with the Morris 1000 and the later 1100. We've got a bit of a history about that one as well. I look forward to being with you again next week for our 101st episode. And we'll get to talk then, I think, about car design and the various skills that go into some of the wonderful shapes that we see around the place. I've enjoyed bringing the show to you. I hope you've enjoyed spending half an hour with me. And I look forward very much to your company next week when we'll do it all again. Thanks for your time. Have a safe week and bye for now.